Failure is not an option.
What difference at this point does it make?
Nobody said it was going to be fun.
This is Real Talk, a fearless, poignant, and intrepid show where truth speaks louder than words. This is Real Talk with your host, Audrey Russo.
The shame, not of this world, so we live on the run. We keep our eyes set, on what is to come.
It happened before. It will happen again. It's just a question of when.
Time's a luxury we don't have.
This is Diana West. I'm the author of American Betrayal and the Death of the Grown-Up. I blog at dianawest.net, and you're listening to Audrey Russo on Real Talk.
Welcome back. If you're just joining us, this is Audrey Russo, and you're listening to Real Talk. The horrors of the Soviet Union are lost on most people in the West today. This is mostly due to the left-leaning in Hollywood, the media, and academia, who treat this barbaric ideology in a quixotic fashion. That's precisely the reason it's imperative that every freedom-loving person in the West read my next guest's book. Vladimir Bukovsky is a Russian-born human rights activist, a writer, and a neurophysiologist. He is celebrated for his part in the campaign to expose and halt the political abuse of psychiatry in the Soviet Union. From the late 1950s to the mid-1970s, he was a prominent figure in the Soviet dissident movement. He spent a total of 12 years in the psychiatric prison hospitals, labor camps, and prisons of the Soviet Union. Vladimir has a rare combination of toughness, common sense, and good humor. He never compromised with his oppressors, even though he was subjugated to the KGB's infamous psychological and biochemical torments during his years in prison and the camps. His unparalleled courage and tenacity inspired a generation, and his standing was dramatically demonstrated when the Kremlin traded him for a Chilean communist leader in 1976. He has remained in vocal opposition to the Soviet system and the shortcomings of its successor regimes in Russia. He's a member of the International Advisory Council of the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation and a member of the International Council of the New York City-based Human Rights Foundation. He is also a senior fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. Vladimir is the author of several best-selling books, including the one we'll be discussing in this segment, Judgment in Moscow. It's my great pleasure to give a Real Talk welcome to Vladimir Bukovsky. Welcome, Vladimir. It's a great pleasure and honor to have you with us. We're going to jump right into this. Many people in this country, having grown up in freedom, are unaware of the horrors that you and countless others in the Soviet Union and the Soviet Empire experienced during its reign of terror. before its demise in 1991. Would you share about some of your experiences that you also shared in the book Judgment in Moscow?
Well, the personal experience of living in these conditions was described in my first book, which was called To Build a Castle. And that was published and republished, so that goes through my personal experience. The second book is mostly analytical about the collapse of Soviet Union and so to say, post-mortem of it. Why it happened, how it happened, and so on. And it's based on the documents I've copied in Kremlin in secret archives of the Politburo of the Communist Party. In 1992, it was a very brief moment when we could look at them, at these archives, because of the court case between Communist Party and President Yeltsin. So it was a constitutional court case, and I was expert at the constitutional court. And in that capacity, I had the right to subpoena documents. So I used this power as much as I could, and copied thousands of documents, which once again became secret when the court case was finished. So my second book, The Judgment in Moscow, is based on these documents.
Right. Was it difficult, after the fall of the Berlin Wall, was it difficult to gain access to those archives?
Well, they usually were closed for anyone or any visitor. But in this case, they were opened because of a court case. So we, the participants in this court case, had the permission to access them. And the permission was only for duration of the case. So otherwise, these archives are completely closed. They're still closed right now. Even those documents I've seen in 1992 are reclassified again. So you can't get them.
So it was only during a certain period of time that you had access. Okay. So what were your most critical findings from the archives?
My most important, strongest impression I've got was a degree to which the Soviets could influence the West, and the West would actually accept the Soviet dictating influence. So they never called bluff, they never, you know, except for very short periods in Ronald Reagan's presidency, or right after World War II, when Harry Truman was the United States president. That was a very brief period when we really had some kind of confrontation. But otherwise, the West would prefer to accept the Soviet position, Soviet demands. It was pretty much an appeasement policy, like the West was conducting vis-a-vis Hitler in the 30s.
Right.
And so the degree the Soviets could influence the West and the West accepted it was quite staggering. I mean, we all knew that there is such influence, but we didn't know to what degree, to what extent it goes.
Right. After the fall and the collapse of the Soviet Union, why did you feel so strongly about putting the regime on public trial?
Well, they obviously committed crimes against humanity, mm-hmm. by all definitions, including the one used in Nuremberg. So, I mean, if that was done for Nazi regime, there is no reason why it shouldn't be done for the communist regime. They committed similar crimes. The difference being that Nazi regime existed only, what, 13 years, while the Soviet regime existed 73 years. So that's one reason. Another reason is that this comparison, this equation between Nazi and communism regimes, we knew that, but the Western establishment would not accept it. Particularly the kind of leftist part of it. Mm-hmm. They would always deny it, they would always say, no, no, it was too different. And although in reality, if you look at these two regimes, they're very much similar. And the crimes committed by communists should have been condemned pretty much like they were condemned in Germany. And that's one reason. The second reason, I could see that unless this condemnation done, the country, I mean, the Russia and former countries of communist bloc would have very little incentive for recovery. And that's exactly what happened. If in Germany after war, it was obvious that the disaster happened because of a Nazi ideology. In Russia after 1991, that was far from obvious. I mean, most people would blame the West for subversive activity and ascribing the collapse of the Soviet Empire to actions of secret services, Western secret services, and all this kind of nonsense. And therefore, they didn't kind of repent. They didn't look into their soul and didn't establish the fact that they did contribute to the disaster which happened to them. So that was very important. And since we didn't have such a condemnation, the development in Russia went completely wrong. It was never kind of analyzed, the reasons for this collapse. And the regime returned. Now, in a slightly different appearance, the kind of a Soviet regime returned. With all these attributes of it, like censorship in the media and political persecutions and even aggressions against neighboring countries. It's all features of the Soviet regime, and they returned. Once, it was not finished conclusively. Like a wounded animal, it just came back at us and continued to do what they used to do.
Sure.
So there are several reasons for necessity of such a condemnation.
Sure. I'm curious, too, as you know, as there were many Nazis that tried to flee justice, did you also find that, as that those that were part of the Soviet regime escaped justice?
Well, I mean, physically, they didn't have necessity to run away from the country, because no one was persecuting them.
Mm.
And although a lot of them lost power, particularly in the Communist Party apparatus, because Communist Party was prohibited by Yeltsin's decree, and its apparatus lost its influence and power. So a lot of them lost their power and prestige, but they were not put on trial or persecuted or even criticized. I mean, it was the transition from the communist regime to non-communist regime was remarkably peaceful.
Mm. Yeah.
And smooth.
Right. At the conclusion of the trial, were you pleased with the outcome? Did you see some justice?
Not entirely. I mean, I couldn't imagine any other decision. Mm-hmm. Yes, the decision was to confirm that Yeltsin's decree, which prohibited Communist Party of Soviet Union, was constitutional within the limits of Constitution. And that was the main point of Communists arguing in the Constitutional Court, that these decrees were unconstitutional. Now, the court confirmed them being constitutional, but the court added up that, of course, people who believe in communism still have these convictions, they are free to create a new Communist Party. And that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, yeah. I'm wondering if you mentioned that no one was pursuing them or prosecuting them, but there was no persecution there. Do you think that's because they had so many friends in the West?
That was one of the reasons. For example, we tried to persuade Yeltsin and his leadership to organize this kind of a trial on the lines of the Nuremberg trial. And there was enormous pressure from the West not to do that. Even opening archives was resisted by the Western political forces.
Wow.
So that was partly so. And of course, Yeltsin and his lot had very little incentive of doing it, because, of course, all of them were involved in the activity of the Communist Party prior to its collapse. In one capacity or another, Yeltsin was actually very high up in the hierarchy. He was a member of Politburo. Mm-hmm. And although he personally didn't commit any crimes, nevertheless, the collective leadership was criminal pretty much like in Nazi Germany, the Nazi Party. So they were not kind of over-enthusiastic about this perspective. But they would agree with our logic. We would argue with them, explaining that it would be very kind of healthy for the country to look critically into its own past, and those who do not analyze its past usually have no future. So in all, they were ready to accept our logic. But the pressure from the West stopped them completely and provided them with a good excuse not to go along these lines.
Right. Is it true that the original publisher in the U.S. wanted you to rewrite the entire book because the left-leaning establishment in the U.S. did not want to see crisis of communism in Moscow turn into a crisis of socialism in the West?
Yeah, well, they didn't say that much.
Yeah.
but for several months, they were after actually having a contract on my book. Several months, they tried to persuade me to change it, to rewrite certain commentaries, even to throw out some documents I quoted in it. And I just give example of it in the first chapter. But at the time, it was really surprising for me. I didn't expect that to happen. It's just a publisher who acquired a book and wants to publish it. Why should he get out of his way to force an author to rewrite it? It's very uncommon. I've published already, 6-7 books, and it never happened to me before.
Wow.
So it was the first time I encountered such a blatant censorship in the United States and Britain. So it delayed the whole publication for a very long time. Although it was safely and successfully published in France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Poland, some Eastern European countries, Russia. It was published in Russian in 1996.
Wow.
Yeah, but it wasn't published in English.
Well, it's disturbing when you think about that, coming out of the West. So just coming was it really surprising to you that it had so many friends here? Communism?
Yeah. Again, the degree of the Soviet influence was surprising for me. The fact that there is some influence, I knew. And we all knew that. It just could be seen in the day-to-day politics, but such a degree when all major publishing houses in the English language world would be afraid of publishing a book. Mind you, book based on documents.
Yeah.
It wasn't my invention, it was documents.
Yeah, that seems to be a plague on the left. So between the time that the publisher wanted, you know, signed your book, and between that time and when they decided, someone got to them and said they didn't want this, correct?
I suppose so. I mean,
yeah.
As far as I understand what happened, they bought the book on the basis of French translation. Mm-hmm. So the publishers, the publishing house people, they read this book in French.
Right.
And apparently their French was not terribly good. So,
yeah.
So they misunderstood a lot of things, you know.
You're right. Okay. You know, Vladimir, what do you hope Judgment in Moscow will teach young people in the West about communism, since their professors are favorable toward this ideology? And they are, sadly.
Well, I mean, to begin with, for me, is standing on the side of the truth is what I did in my life. The most important thing is to reestablish the truth, which got so distorted in the process of confrontation, of ideological warfare. So establishing the truth is the most important thing in my view, whatever the outcome. That's the first thing. Second, of course, like anyone writing on such subjects, I would hope that the mistakes of history, mistakes of people of that generation would not be repeated again. I wanted to warn them that the system they created, it couldn't live. It was dead upon the birth. It couldn't function. And I analyzed it through documents and showed how it slowly suffocated and how this crisis was growing and growing. So the hope was that the future generations would not repeat this mistaken path. They wouldn't go this mistaken path again. And thirdly, I would hope people would analyze their own past and the past of the world, and try to make some conclusions, some lessons out of it. And the example is very important. If you look at the massive experiment, the communist experiment was made in huge countries like China, like Russia, you know, it's huge countries, and failed. It was important to see the roots of it, to see the reasons for that, and hopefully it would help other countries to go through decommunization process, so to speak. China, by the way, is still there. Vietnam is there, you know, Cuba, and now Venezuela, a new country suddenly turned the same mistaken way. And we all know in advance that it's going to collapse. It's not going to survive. Nothing could survive this model. Nevertheless, the whole country just turned and went through all these pains again, which makes me a bit desperate.
That you don't want to see this again. I have to ask you this. You have people here in this country, socialists, that will say that the reason that the Soviet Union failed is because they weren't doing communism correctly. What's your response to that?
So who in the world made it correctly, tell me? Chinese did it wrongly, North Koreans did it wrongly, Vietnamese did it wrongly, Cubans did it wrongly. Who did it correctly? Name me any communist country which was actually successful and thriving and prospering. None of them. And more than that, I mean, any country which played this idea of socialism would be in the crisis proportionally to a degree they went on the way to socialism. The more socialism they introduced in their system, the less successful this country were.
Right.
So that needs to be explained.
Yes.
Yeah. No one forced Cubans to repeat the Soviet model. They could try anything else. But the concept itself, and I try to explain it in the book, the very principle on which socialism is built and organized, is wrong. It cannot live. It's dead upon birth.
Right. Yeah. So it failed because it can't exist. It can't support itself.
No.
Yeah. Simple as that. Right. Vladimir, I always ask everyone on the show, where can the listeners follow and support your work and purchase your book, Judgment in Moscow? Where can they do that?
Well, it could be bought from the publishers. It could be bought from Amazon.com.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I wouldn't know all the ways. You better ask the publishers, because they use all kind of electronic ways. Now,
yes,
it became very popular to have books in electronic forms and audio forms and whatever. But it's all done, so it's available.
Yes, okay.
Now, I've got the copy, just kind of preliminary copy, the one which was sent to potential reviewers. But that's a paper edition, so it's a traditional book.
Yes.
But apart from that, there is all sorts of, all forms of publication.
Yes, yes. And as always, I will have links so that everyone can get a copy of Judgment in Moscow and your other work. I will have those links in my after show, which is now on the live show page. Just go to AudreyRusso.com, click on the on-air button, and right under the show description, you'll find all the links and info that Vladimir just shared. Thank you so much, Vladimir, for your courage and your willingness to share your story and your work. Will you join us again on the show? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Until then, may God bless you, your work, and may God save
you. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.